I'm Barbara Lane, Director of Arts and Ideas at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco, and I welcome you to BINA, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the JCCSF. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of BINA, our guest is Russian-American journalist and activist Masha Gessen. She's joined in conversation by National Security Editor of The Washington Post, Peter Finn. And now, join Stephanie Singer on stage at the JCCSF as she introduces Masha Gessen and Peter Finn. Masha Gessen is a Russian-American journalist and author whose most recent book is The Brothers, The Road to an American Tragedy, which tells the story of the Tsarnaev brothers. Just last month, Jahar Tsarnaev was convicted of all 30 charges against him in the Boston Marathon bombing trial. She's also the author of The Man Without a Face, The Unlikely Rise of Vladimir Putin, and Words Will Break Cement, The Passion of Pussy Riot. Masha Gessen has written extensively on LGBT rights and helped found the Pink Triangle campaign in opposition to Russian legislation banning gay propaganda. She's been described as Russia's leading LGBT rights activist and has said herself that for many years she was probably the only publicly out gay person in the whole of Russia. Here tonight in conversation with Masha Gessen is Peter Finn, Washington Post national security correspondent. Please join me in welcoming Masha Gessen and Peter Finn to the JCCSF.
Thank you.
Good evening. It's wonderful to be in San Francisco, and I'm especially happy to be here with Masha, a gifted and fearless journalist whose work I've admired for a long time.
Thank you, Peter.
And we've recently had the opportunity to work together when she blogged for The Washington Post. Let's jump right in. Russia has experienced a lot of trauma and turmoil since the fall of the Soviet Union, and you've witnessed most of it. But as you look at Russia now, the war in Ukraine, the assassination of Boris Nemtsov, the crackdown on the LGBT community, an opposition that looks like it's been completely marginalized, a docile media. How pessimistic are you about the current situation and the opportunity, if any, for change?
Very. That may be all I have to say on the topic. You've gone through the whole list, but I think things are even worse than what you described. It's not, you know, just the war in Ukraine. It's Russia perceives itself as a country at war with the West. And so it's a war that's going to escalate. I also think that the next stage of that war is going to be a crackdown on what Putin has increasingly been referring to as the fifth column, the enemy within, or what he's also called the national traitors. So there's going to be a major political crackdown that will make the last 3 years of political crackdown seem like a dress rehearsal. So I think we'll see a lot of arrests and possibly a lot more physical attacks like the assassination of Boris Nemtsov.
And you wrote in the New York Times that the scariest thing about the murder of Boris Nemtsov was that he himself did not scare anyone. And if he was politically harmless, why was he killed?
I think he was killed as a message, first of all. I don't think that... a couple of things about his murder. He was killed in plain view of the Kremlin. So he was killed on a bridge that crosses the Moscow River directly across from the Kremlin. And if you so much as take out a zoom camera on that bridge, you will have the police on you within a matter of seconds. I was once in a group of bicyclists who were going under the bridge, and the presidential guard ran out to intercept us because it was an unusual occurrence to see a group of bicyclists go under the bridge. So we see on the surveillance tapes that there was a body lying on the bridge for at least 10 minutes, and nobody came to look at what happened.
So what does that say?
Well, one other thing that I want to say before I say what it says is that Berezinskiy was also like other people who are opposed to Putin, and I try not to use the word opposition. I can explain why not in a minute. But like other people who are actively opposed to Putin, he was under constant surveillance, and he would especially have been under constant surveillance that day because the following day there was going to be a protest march that he had organized. So this is a murder that very clearly took place in plain view of the Kremlin, of the Presidential Guard, and the FSB, the Russian secret police. So at the very least, it was a crime that was allowed to happen. At most, it was a crime that was actually carried out by the Kremlin. But what it communicates is something that is also related to an occurrence in Moscow a week earlier, which was the so-called anti-Maidan march. And this is the latest of these Kremlin-organized and sponsored so-called popular movements, or fake popular movements. This one is explicitly intended to prevent a Ukrainian-like revolution in Russia, as though Russia had any chance of seeing a Ukrainian-type revolution. And a lot of the people who marched in that 30,000-strong march in Moscow actually carried placards with a portrait of Nemtsov that identified him as an organizer of the Ukrainian revolution. So the message of that march was that the Kremlin is forming and unleashing a force, you know, a paramilitary force, a band of thugs, for the very explicit purpose of attacking people who are opposed to Putin. And their first target was Nemtsov.
Is that organized by the Kremlin?
Or it is organized by the Kremlin, yeah.
So you see them as directly complicit in the
the
murder?
Yes, I do. Yes.
Do you think they directly organized it?
I don't think that's necessary. I mean, there isn't a sort of clear chain of command is actually not necessary in an environment like that, where the most important messages are messages of what kind of violence can be carried out with impunity, what kind of violence will be interpreted as being done in the name of the regime and to help the regime.
And I mean, who are these people then? Do you have any sense? Are they part of the state apparatus? Are they part of the FSB? Are they people who support Putin? I mean,
well, there are certainly people who support Putin. I think they're opportunistic thugs, basically.
Who know they have free rein.
Exactly. And they will join whatever entity will allow them to have free rein and engage in violence with impunity.
If you listen to people in the Kremlin and some in state media, they argue that they're in an information war with the West, and that we're all swimming in a sea of lies. There are our lies, their lies, your lies, my lies, and that there's no difference between the New York Times and Russia Today. I mean, do you see that's what is directing Russian state media policy?
I think it goes deeper than that, and that's a really interesting question, because I actually think that that's one of the few things they say that really and truly express their worldview. I think the people who run Russian media or work for Russian media really believe that we're all liars, that the whole world is constructed exactly this way. Everything is bought and sold. Everyone is bought and sold. No one ever holds sincere convictions. Everything is said for a purpose, said in the name of the highest bidder, and they're so sincerely convinced that this is not just the way they conduct their lives, but the way that the entire world works, that they interpret any message coming at them from the outside as an expression of that same event.
But do you see, is that top to bottom, or that is just the leadership? Is everyone that cynical?
I think it's pervasive, yeah. And I think it's really what we've inherited from the totalitarian society. That's a part of the Soviet legacy, where, you know, for 70 years we lived in a country that where every word was used to mean its opposite. And, you know, when they said democracy, they meant lack of democracy. When they said freedom, they meant prison. I mean, read 1984.
But if you walk into a Russian media organization, you'll see people, many who were born after the fall of the Soviet Union.
Well, the fall of the Soviet Union wasn't accompanied by a dissembling of that system of propaganda. It wasn't, you know, Russia actually made a series of choices in the early 1990s to avoid reckoning with its past. I mean, Russia never, you know, removed Soviet monuments. Russia never banned Soviet movies from TV. Russia never prosecuted the Communist Party. That's a really interesting story that, you know, Russia assembled, the prosecutor's office assembled a case against the Communist Party to the tune of 80 volumes and then placed it under lock and key and decided to let sleeping dogs lie. So, you know, the generation of people who grew up in the 90s had this really schizophrenic experience of reality where their parents, on the one hand, were going out and trying to make a living and trying to navigate a world that had become suddenly very difficult and very confusing. And at the same time, they were watching Soviet movies on television when they weren't watching Latin American soap operas. And in the Soviet movies, everything was so clear, and everything was so beautiful, and everyone was so beautiful, sort of spiritually and physically, and all that seemed, you know, necessary to have happened is just to return that to that imaginary period of total clarity.
But, you know, the experience in Eastern Europe with prosecution, with lustration, as it was called, has been mixed, and some people, you know, feel that that kind of persecution could divide the societies in ways that would not be helpful to democratic development.
Well, I think we should explain what lustrations were, right? Lustration is a process that was set into motion in countries like Germany and the Czech Republic, where people who'd held certain jobs, say, in the security apparatus or in the Communist Party apparatus, were banned from holding state jobs. And so that meant they were identified and they were officially disqualified. I don't know that that kind of reckoning always works, but I'm pretty sure it's the only thing that works.
Because we had a version of that reckoning in Iraq, which certainly didn't work, when the Ba'athists were, from at all levels, were tossed out of government and the army was disbanded. It may not be a parallel experience, but...
I think it's probably a different experience when it's done it by a country under military occupation.
True. When you talk about Eastern Europe and Central Europe, we see the Kremlin now making, in some ways, strange alliances with far-right parties and in Eastern Europe. What do you think is motivating this?
The Kremlin is completely politically opportunistic. They have a mission, and the mission, and they have an idea, right? So the idea is that Russia is a country that is part of the traditional values civilization, which is at war with Western civilization. Western civilization has been trying to force its decadent values down Russians' throats, and the throats of other traditional values countries. And Russia is the only traditional values country that has the courage of its convictions to go to war over traditional values. Right? So that's sort of the basic idea underlying Russia's policies. So there, you know, there's nothing in that idea there's no political kernel there. And it actually allows Russia to make weird political alliances because it sees itself as being in confrontation with the West. And so any party in Western Europe that is opposed to the European Union is a good ally. So that can be the far right or the far left.
So, as we saw in Greece,
they brought the far right and the far left together. I mean, Russia was instrumental in that. In France, it's the far right. In Finland, it's the far right. In Germany, they're reaching out to both sides of the political spectrum.
So, well, how much of this is driven by Putin himself, by the president? I mean, let's get to a basic question about what drives Vladimir Putin and what kind of Russia does he want?
What drives Vladimir Putin is that he wants to stay in power, and he plans to do it for life, and he never plans to die. So that, you know, that sort of creates a very high benchmark. Because, yeah, he needs to stay in power eternally. And he needs a lofty enough mission to ensure that he stays in power eternally, which is, I think, you know, why this idea of Russia as a civilization state, and this idea of a traditional value civilization, they are suitable. They're ambitious enough to support this plan for staying in power eternally. Now, in terms of who is pulling the levers in the Kremlin, On the one hand, I think it's right to acknowledge that it's a closed system and we have only anecdotal evidence of what goes on in there. The fact that it's a closed system is terrible. I mean, it basically means that it's the kind of system that can only implode. It cannot really be affected by outside forces. From what I've seen and what I've been able to sort of, the information I've been able to collect, is a lot of levers are really concentrated in Putin's own hands.
But, and, I mean, you wrote a biography of Putin. I mean, how difficult is it to report on him or to gather information on him, to talk to people in his inner circle, to talk to people in just beyond that point?
It wasn't any more difficult than to report the book on the Tsarnaev brothers. In some ways, it was easier.
Really? I think people would be surprised that getting inside the Kremlin is easier than...
Than getting inside the FBI? Yes. I mean, the Kremlin... the Kremlin is full of vain, mediocre people who... actually, that doesn't really market us particularly different from the FBI, but there were people who wanted to talk to me just for the glory of talking to a journalist, and who I think, you know, didn't have a strong idea of discipline or loyalty that would prevent them from talking to me. There's also a lot of the work that I did when I was writing the book about Putin, The Man Without a Face, was just looking very closely at his public statements, because I think that that's sort of part of what journalists should do. There's a lot of information out there that sometimes we don't take enough time to examine and interpret. And I think that Putin was a very strange politician. He was a politician who hadn't had a public record before becoming leader of this huge country. He had been a secret agent his entire life. So... he was able to communicate what he wanted the world to know about him when he came to power. And it was actually a manageable amount of information. I mean, I could like listen to every recording ever made of his speeches several times over and still have time to write the book in a couple of years. But it was very interesting, for example, to read closely his official biography, which was based on a series of interviews that he did with a team of three journalists. And he told the same stories over and over again, and these are the stories that he wanted to have out there. And these were all stories about how he got into fights, and they're all the fights would always play out in the same fashion. So Putin loses his temper and hits somebody, and then seems to calm down for a while, and then loses his temper again and goes after that person when they least expect it. And you would get that story from Putin and from other people talking about Putin, you know, with his stamp of approval. And so what he basically wanted to communicate was that he was a vengeful thug who had trouble controlling his temper. I mean, he came right out and said it, and nobody particularly wanted to listen.
And but he was talking about when he was a kid and his courtyard
fights. And a young KGB officer. He even emphasized, or had someone else emphasize, that he was willing to risk his entire career to get into a fight on the subway in St. Petersburg.
And I mean, how formative do you think the KGB experience was for him? I mean, he spent a period of time before the collapse of the Soviet Union. He was a lieutenant colonel. He was in a backwater in East Germany. I mean, he wasn't a prominent KGB operative.
He wasn't prominent, but he was very committed. And I also don't think that he left the KGB when he says he did, which was in 1991
He kind of said he left, and then he said he left again.
Exactly, which suggests that maybe he didn't leave. And his story about leaving the KGB is infinitely changeable and changing and not credible at all. But he was born into the KGB. His father was an NKVD officer and then sort of an active reserve NKVD. NKVD was the precursor agency to the KGB. He had ambitions of joining the KGB from the time he was a kid. He first tried to volunteer when he was a high school student. He finally got recruited into the KGB when he graduated from university. And all he ever wanted was to be the secret agent ruling the world from the shadows. He didn't particularly want to be president of Russia, ruling the country openly, although he seems to have gotten the taste of it after a while.
Okay. You're listening to journalist and activist Masha Gessen, whose new book is The Brothers, The Road to an American Tragedy. She's joined in conversation by Peter Finn on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
When he was in East Germany when East Germany when the wall came down, and there's this famous, you know, Moscow is silent. They're there, they're trying to figure out what to do, and nothing is coming from Moscow. I mean, how formative do you think that experience was for him?
I think it's huge. And again, I'm not so much playing sort of the armchair psychologist as I'm just listening to what he's told us. It's clearly a really important thing that happened to him. So what happened, he worked as a paper pusher in the KGB office in Dresden, so a small city in Germany. Germany was being rocked by anti-Soviet protests. Protesters gathered in front of the KGB building in Dresden. Putin was afraid that that people were about to storm the building. He called the Soviet Army headquarters in Berlin and asked for protection. And they said, we can't send anybody unless we get an order from Moscow, and Moscow is silent. And so he went back inside the building and started burning documents that were collected in this building, and he burnt them in the stove until the stove cracked from the heat.
You are one of, I mean, among the people I know who've actually met Putin. You were invited to the Kremlin, which struck me as highly unusual, but I'm wondering if you could tell us...
It struck me as highly unusual, too.
If you could tell us that what happened, why you were invited and what happened.
So I wasn't invited because I wrote a book about Putin, but this happened about 6 months after the book came out. I was editing a popular science magazine, and I was asked to send... my publisher called me on a Saturday morning and asked me to send a reporter to cover Putin hang gliding with the Siberian cranes. And I took a very... really, actually, not a very brave stand. I said, look, you know, we're a popular science magazine. We don't have to do this. We can just... I actually have a story assigned on the Siberian crane, on the campaign to repopulate the population of Siberian cranes. And, we could just do, like, without Putin, because if I send a reporter, then the reporter will see something, and then I will be obligated to put it in the magazine, and you're not going to want me to put it in the magazine, and we're going to have a problem. Let's just not see anything. And the publisher said, no, why don't you send a reporter... And then we don't have to publish anything. And I said, well, that I can't do. If the reporter goes then and brings something back, then I have to publish it. So he said, well, okay, in that case, you're fired. And then on Monday, I went into work and signed the papers about my firing. And I tweeted, and there are probably some Russian speakers in the audience, I tweeted, «Я покидаю вокруг света, спасибо Путину за это». I'm not going to translate. Anyway, it actually indicated that I was leaving my job and it was Putin's fault. And so he called me the next day.
He called you directly?
He called me on the phone.
And he said, it's Vladimir Vladimirovich.
He said, it's Vladimir Vladimirovich. And, and I thought, well, this is like a really inventive prank, and I have to come up... I have to come up with something really witty to say because this is going to be on YouTube. But it was early in the morning. I couldn't come up with anything. And he kept talking, and he said, I want to talk to you about my nature conservation efforts. Do you mind? And I said, no, I don't mind, but like, how do I know you are who you say you are? And he said, well, after we hang up, the deputy head of my administration is going to call you and schedule a meeting, and then I will show up, and then you'll know that I am who I say I am. And that sounded reasonable, so so I went to the Kremlin, and the amazing thing about it, aside from just the experience of of hearing from somebody who, in a way, I felt like I had made up. I mean, I'd spent all this time trying to get in the man's head, but I'd never seen him in person. So he was like a character in my book.
Right.
And he was going to come alive. And it wasn't the first time that I wrote a book about someone I couldn't interview. I had the book before that was about the Russian mathematician Grigory Perelman, who solved the Poincaré conjecture and then refused the $1 million prize for the person who solved it. And so I, after Putin and I got off the phone, I Google hanged out my editor and said, "Yeah, Putin just called." And she said, "How are you?" Meaning, like, do you feel safe? And I was like, "Well, I'm excited, but it would be more exciting if Perelman had called." But I really wanted to see what this person was like.
And
he was pretty much the person in the book. He was there were no surprises there. Part of me was hoping that he would like come alive and wouldn't be as two-dimensional as the person that I had described, but he wasn't. But the highlights were basically two. One was that when I walked in, he said, "I like kitties and puppies and little animals." and that was meant to communicate that he really is serious about the Siberian cranes. And the other thing was that he didn't know who I was. I mean, he knew I was editor of this magazine that he liked, and the idea of calling me in was to put me back in my job because he liked the magazine a lot, and if he likes something, then he thinks he owns it, which is sort of part of what's gone wrong with Russia. But he had not been briefed on me. He didn't realize I was an American citizen. He didn't realize I had been an opposition journalist for a long time.
Or
that I'd written a biography.
That's unbelievable. I mean, what kind of staff does he have that...
well, the problem is that for him to know that a book that critical of him had come out in 20 languages, someone would have had to tell him. And nobody wanted to tell him that. Especially after he called me. So.
You said, you know, he struck you as two-dimensional. And I think a lot of people would find that, you know, hard to fathom. Because here is a man who, he did come to power as president. He's held on to power for 15 years. He's shown quite an ability to wield it and to crush his enemies. How does a two-dimensional figure manage all of that?
It's a really interesting argument because I keep getting into this conversation with a lot of people, and it's like Stephen Kotkin, who is a great historian of Russia and the author of a new biography of Stalin, he mentioned this in a recent article that I make a case for Putin being a mediocrity and an accidental president, and then he writes this one line, but no accidental person can stay in power this long. And I don't know where that assertion comes from. Because actually, well, he has, right? And there is no definitive proof that he's three-dimensional or intelligent or skilled. And there are a lot of indications that he's not very well-educated, not very well-informed man with very strong instincts for sort of playing people off against one another and for holding on to power. But he's also... in office in a country where sort of the magic of office is huge and where it proved very easy for him to dismantle the democratic mechanisms that existed when he came in and to set into motion all the totalitarian mechanisms that had been dormant for a couple
right.
of decades.
You mentioned the storks, and that's just one of many stunts that we've seen. You know, he's gone diving in the sea for antiquities. He's been with the tigers and...
And the polar bear.
And he's been in a submersible, and he's flown and a fighter
flown
jet.
And driven a submarine, yeah.
So what's this about? Is this burnishing a public image for the Russian public?
Well,
I mean, the bear chest, the horseback, all of it.
There are sort of distinct periods. Like, there was his early, probably his first 8 years were all about driving. So it was like flying a plane and piloting... piloting the submersible and then piloting an aircraft carrier and a submarine. And so I think these were sort of, he was king of the world and transportation. And then there was like the king of the jungle period, which was which was the Siberian cranes and the tigers and the polar bear. And these are always the largest animals of their kind. So they're very carefully chosen. And then there was the bare-chested sort of sex symbol period of virility. And now there's the war in Ukraine.
He remains, I mean, if we can talk a little bit about his popularity or his apparent popularity among the Russian public. And I think Levada recently had it, which is an independent polling agency in Russia, had his approval ratings over 80%.
88, yeah.
Yeah, obviously the state media, all of that plays a role, but at the same time there seems to be some connection there, that his popularity isn't entirely manufactured.
I think that it's really difficult to talk about because all the language that we have to talk about opinion polls and popularity figures it's all based on our experience of studying opinion in democratic societies. And the thing is that what Putin has done over the last 3 years really is setting in motion the mechanisms of a totalitarian society. And I think he's done something that has never been done before, which is retrofit a totalitarian system. And one of the things that have kicked in is what happens to popular opinion in a totalitarian society, which is that it's a matter of survival to know what to think and to say. And it's very, very difficult to draw a distinction between what people say sincerely and what people say because they know they're supposed to say it. Because actually they know they're supposed to be sincere about it. In fact, it's a matter of survival to be sincere about it.
Right.
And there's a very, very small minority, roughly that, 12 to 15%, that stays stably anti-Putin and anti-Putin Kremlin policy in opinion polls that seems to have some resistance to that.
Right. One of the things that we've seen emerge in his latest term is this kind of state-sponsored homophobia. And I'm wondering if you could tell us, firstly, what this anti-gay propaganda law is and does, and why you think it emerged at this juncture.
I think it emerged almost by accident. What happened 3 years ago was that Putin came back for his third term as president, and he was faced with something unprecedented, which is popular protests. And there were protests going on all over Russia. And he found them really genuinely frightening. The protesters didn't have any mechanisms for overthrowing Putin or for even preventing his claiming any percentage in the election, which he ended up claiming 63% in the presidential election. But he is actually personally and historically very frightened of protesters, and I think that goes back to that scene in Dresden, which is so important to him. And he felt like the Kremlin had lost control of the country. This was something that he communicated to his close subordinates, that they had let this happen. So they needed to engineer a crackdown, and they also needed to mobilize the country against the protesters. And so he started out by throwing out just random insults at the protesters. The first thing he said about them was that they were personally inspired by Hillary Clinton, and that the white ribbon that became the symbol of the protesters that a lot of people wore on their lapels, he said that from a distance, it looked like a spent prophylactic, and that people, for some reason, decided to pin these empty condoms to their lapels, which is some sort of allusion to a lack of virility on the part of the protesters, I guess. And then, it was a short step to starting to gay bait the protesters, and that really got traction. And the thing, this is what Tim Snyder calls this a calculated cacophony. They throw out a lot of messages, and then they are actually obsessed with feedback. They're obsessed with polling numbers, so they keep a very close track of what works. And the gay baiting really worked, and I think it worked for very clear reasons. It was great shorthand for saying that they're other, they're Western, they're not. They're not Russian. They're enemies of Russia. They are also part of what has been strange about Russia and uncomfortable about Russia since the Soviet Union collapsed, because we didn't have any openly gay people until after the Soviet Union collapsed. So you could say all of that in just by gay baiting the protesters. And that's, then it sort of started ballooning into this whole idea of traditional values. And you know, obviously, I'm simplifying, and I'll write a whole book about that, and it'll be a little bit more complicated. But Russia has always, the Russian government has traditionally worked hand in hand with the Russian Orthodox Church, and especially in times of crisis, and this was true even during the Soviet period, that the Kremlin would reach for the church,
like to, during World War II,
exactly, to fortify its position. So this was happening as Putin was running his presidential campaign, which is why Pussy Riot went to jail, and Pussy Riot were protesting the fact that the patriarch of the Russian Orthodox Church was campaigning for Putin. So this unholy alliance of the Kremlin and the Russian Orthodox Church came up with this idea of the traditional value of civilization. And the centerpiece of that idea was the anti-gay campaign.
And how is the LGBT community responding? Are people leaving? Are they hiding? Are they able to fight back in any way?
I don't think it's possible to fight back, and not just because the LGBT community is still quite small and weak in Russia, but it's impossible to fight back against the monolith of the Russian state with all the media at its disposal, all the mechanisms of repression at its disposal. I mean, there's nothing you can
right.
You can put up against that. So a lot of people have left. And a lot of people have come to this country. I know of hundreds of people who've come just in New York City, LGBT refugees in New York City. There are a lot of people in San Francisco, a lot of people in D.C. Some people are trying to stay low and hope that this ends in the foreseeable future.
And obviously this affected you personally. I mean, you've had death threats in the past over the course of your career. You've taken great risks in reporting in Chechnya, among other places. And yet, at this moment, you finally decided you had to leave Russia.
Well, reporting in Chechnya, in some ways, I mean, war reporting, which I think you've done too, is you go there and then you come back and you're safe. And it's like the fact that you can remove yourself from danger is actually part of what makes war reporting so appealing and addictive. When you're threatened in your own home, that's a little different. And basically, it was communicated to me that the state would go after my oldest son, who's adopted, and that they would try to annul the adoption. So that was even sort of before I got into the technicalities and the issue of how this was legally possible, which it is, as it turns out. Just sort of the visceral understanding that they could actually go after my kids was too much to take.
Right. And you mentioned the Orthodox Church. I mean, Russia has four official religions, right? Orthodoxy, Judaism, Islam, Buddhism. How are the other denominations responding to this close political relationship now between the Orthodox Church and the Kremlin?
That's a great question. Well, the relationship, actually, the cooperative relationship, is working with all the denominations. So. And you can see that even sort of for those of us paying attention to it, there was a recent photo op with Putin and representatives of the four official religions, all you know carefully placed to communicate the hierarchy of religions. The two rabbis sort of standing farthest away from Putin, and the mufti a little bit closer, and you know the patriarch closest. The relationship between the more liberal wings of each religion and the more conservative and the traditional state-controlled structures, which never went anywhere, basically mimics, in all the other religions, it mimics what's happened in the Russian Orthodox Church, where the more liberal wing has been all but destroyed in the last few years.
This is Bina, KALW series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's program features journalist and activist Masha Gessen, whose new book is The Brothers, The Road to an American Tragedy. She's joined in conversation by Peter Finn. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
You know, the West and the United States in particular over the last several years has, you know, struggled in how to, what kind of relationship to have with Russia and with President Putin. You know, we've had engagement and then we've had isolation, we've had reset, we now have sanctions. I mean, obviously you're not in government, but is it appropriate to isolate Russia, to sanction Russia, or as others argue, Stephen Cohen, for instance, that it is in the national security interest of the United States, regardless of the form of government in Russia, to have a working relationship with that government?
Russia is an extremely unreliable partner. I mean, the latest example is are the negotiations with Iran, which Russia basically participated. It appeared to be participating as a partner in the negotiations, and then the day after the negotiations were completed and the deal was signed, Russia announced its unilateral decision to sell weapons to Iran. So, and this is it's a classic sort of Putin gesture. It's the you've been had again message. Russia has no particular strategic interest in selling those particular weapons to Iran. It does have a strong interest in communicating that sort of message to the United States. So I don't see any argument for dealing with a partner that will reliably be unreliable at every turn. Certainly with Ukraine, we've seen that there is nothing that the West can do that can influence what Putin does. So that sort of frees the West up to do the right thing.
Which is?
Which is not to be in bed with a dictator, and not to aid him in any way, and not to engage him in any way, and not to give him the honor of being recognized as a partner in any enterprise.
Turning to the United States, and in particular to Boston, you've just published a book, obviously, on the bombing. And I guess the question everyone asks, and this won't be the first time you've heard it, but is, you know, why did they do it? What did they want to achieve?
That's the question that we always ask about terrorists. And the traditional answer that has been given since 9/11 is you have to find sort of the radicalization narrative, right? And the radicalization narrative, which we get from both the FBI and a lot of the media coverage, is there's a huge international organization that recruits a young man or two young men and takes them through identifiable stages where they're first pre-radicalized, then radicalized, and finally they become terrorists. This obviously didn't happen in this case. It actually hasn't happened in other cases either, but this case has really exposed the fact that it doesn't work that way. So it's forced the government into the rather uncomfortable position of using a new term, which we heard over and over again during the trial in Boston, which is self-radicalization. So it's like Tamerlan Tsarnaev recruited himself and took himself through the stages of radicalizing himself. Which sounds silly because it's useless, right? The whole radicalization theory it's not exactly meaningless, but it's useless in the sense that radical beliefs actually don't predict terrorist behavior. Most people who hold radical beliefs, including radical beliefs that support violence, don't go and build bombs. Some of the people who go and build bombs and even set them off don't have radical beliefs. So, and terrorism scholars have been telling us this for years, right? It's the FBI that has been telling us a different story. So I think that, and what terrorism scholars have been telling us is that people like the Tsarnaev brothers actually fit the profile that they see perfectly. What they usually see is immigrants, young men with a secular education, so not steeped in religion, contrary to the popular image of this, usually middle with a middle-class background, but increasingly marginalized, and usually with a very small enclosed social circle that within which they form sort of all of their connections. All of this is true of the Tsarnaev brothers. It's also true of millions of other people who
right.
also don't go and build bombs, right? So, I mean, we keep coming up against...
But, so is there an X factor? Is there something that pushes someone over the line?
I don't think there's an identifiable factor. What I do think is important to understand is what sort of what is so tempting and alluring on the other side, which is that terrorism is a ticket to belonging. It's a ticket to belonging to something great, right? You can go directly from being a nobody, and nobody feels more like a nobody than an immigrant, to you know being somebody who declares war on a great power. And the miraculous power of terrorism is that you know, not only do you feel like you belong to a great entity and you declare war on a great power, but the power accepts your declaration of war. I mean, the entire rhetoric with which not just the United States, but the entire Western world reacts to terrorism is this rhetoric of war. They have attacked us. Well, actually, no, they didn't attack us. They set off bombs. They committed a horrible crime. They killed 3 people and injured 264, and 16 people lost their legs. But they didn't attack the American nation. They set off bombs at the Boston Marathon. They committed a horrible crime, and they should be treated as criminals, not as
So we should criminalize this. Yes. We shouldn't make it a matter of war or conflict or whatever.
Yes, I think that, you know, the sort of like the spectacle, if you remember from January, of the leaders of the European nations
right.
marching in formation through the streets of Paris, which seems sort of so inspiring at first sight, is exactly, I think, the wrong reaction. Because why should they have the power to get, you know, Angela Merkel to march in Paris?
So what should Angela Merkel or François Hollande or anyone do? I mean, they can't sit in their office and ignore it.
I think they should prosecute them to the fullest extent of the law.
And leave it
while
at that.
Treating them as common criminals, you know, as heinous murderers.
And the trial itself. I mean, you've written that you found the quality of lawyering at the trial really excellent.
It's
extraordinary. But at the same time, you found it somehow not satisfactory in getting to what we might call the truth.
Although writing about it for you was really fun. Thank you. But it's. I mean. The American justice system is not designed to get at the truth. And that's, you know, it's not a bad thing. It's just it's the adversarial process isn't designed to conduct an investigation. Like France has an inquisitory system where the judge can actually order witnesses in and can propose questions to try to figure out what happened. The American process is designed to hear 2 different narratives. And to see who makes the most convincing case. And the point of it is to apportion guilt and assign punishment. The point of it is not to get a comprehensive picture of what happened. That's the FBI's job. And the FBI hasn't done its job.
But at the same time, I mean, if you look at what the defense did, I mean, we got a fairly simple narrative from them, which is he did it. And mm-hmm. their focus has been on and not disputing his guilt, but on preventing him from being sentenced to death.
Which is exactly their job, and I think they've done it spectacularly. I mean, it's been amazing to watch. It's also been amazing to watch the prosecution, which was even more of a surprise for me, or actually that was a surprise. Just the way that they selected witnesses, the way they staged the case, the way they always timed it, to go from sort of mundane in the morning and incredibly emotional in the late afternoon to let to have the jury go home at the end of the week, pondering the absolute worst of what happened at the marathon. I mean, it was like watching an incredible theater production, and it was devastating. I mean, I think it was devastating for not just for the people in the courtroom, but for the entire city of Boston, which is why you've heard victims coming out against the death penalty and just asking to have this thing over with because
right.
it is so emotionally powerful. Why do I find it unsatisfying? Because there are questions that haven't been answered and that can't be answered in court. So one question is, where were the bombs made? And the FBI testified in court that they don't know where the bombs were made. They know that they weren't made in Tamerlan's apartment and they weren't made in Jahar's dorm room. So they were made somewhere else. If they were made somewhere else, then who else was involved? Was this person unwittingly involved, whoever owns or rents the space where they build the bombs? Or was this a full accomplice? And we don't know unless the FBI tells us. And then the biggest question is, what was the relationship between the FBI and Tamer Lansarnaev, somebody whom they interviewed at least three times in 2011 as a terrorism risk? How come he was then able to build a bomb and set it off?
Well, Janet Napolitano, who reviewed your book in the New York Times, said you were a conspiracy theorist for raising questions about the role of the FBI, because from her point of view, the FBI does thousands of assessments of people every year, and the fact that they didn't immediately recognize him is indicative, from her point of view, of nothing.
Janet Napolitano seems a little conspiracy-minded about conspiracy theories, because all I did was raise the question. Here's what happened. The bombs went off on Monday afternoon. On Tuesday morning, FBI technical specialists had isolated the likenesses of the brothers from surveillance tapes. And then for 3 days, basically until after Tamer Lansarnaev was killed, they couldn't identify the brothers. I'm assuming that I know that the Joint Terrorism Task Force in Boston isn't that large. The number of people who go out to interview real live terrorism suspects is finite. 3 days is definitely enough time to show each one of those people the pictures that they had isolated from the videotapes. Is it conceivable they didn't show them the pictures? Absolutely, but it's a sign of incompetence. And incompetence may well be the biggest missing link that the FBI is not disclosing.
Throughout the proceeding in Boston, the defendant has sat there. I mean, have you learned anything about him through this whole process?
He's sat there looking like he's a little bit older than the teenager he was during the marathon bombing. He's been mostly impassive. You can't really tell anything about his emotional reaction, except that he will not make eye contact with any of the witnesses. It's been really kind of moving for me to watch his relationship with the defense, because he's under special administrative measures, or SAMs, which is a particular kind of hell imposed on terrorism suspects. It's like extreme solitary. Basically, he has no physical contact with anybody but prison guards and his lawyers when they come to visit. He cannot have visits from anyone but immediate family, and no more than once a week, and he has to speak English to them because the FBI has to be able to listen in. He can only write one letter a week to the tune of three single-sided sheets of paper, and only to an immediate family member, and the FBI has to be able to read it. So he has almost no human contact, and it's very clear that the members of the defense team go to pains to have that kind of human contact with him.
But it's only going to get worse. I mean, assuming that he gets a life sentence, he will spend it at a supermax in Colorado where the conditions will be as severe as you just described. Maybe to prevent him getting the death penalty, they're saving him for hell on earth.
I think that's a distinct possibility. And some people have asked the question, is principled opposition to the death penalty, which is what drives his extraordinary defense lawyers, reason enough to condemn him to a lifetime of total and profound isolation?
Well, on that happy note, we'll...
I knew we were going to end on a hopeful note.
We'll move to questions from the audience.
Hi, Masha. I'm wondering if you can update us on Pussy Riot today. Where are they at? The last I saw, they were on House of Cards protesting a fake Vladimir Putin.
So the two members of Pussy Riot, Надежда Толоконникова and Мария Алехина, who ended up serving time in jail, have emerged as, I think, really extraordinary activists. They have founded a prisoners' rights organization. They're trying to work for both individual prisoners and prison reform. I don't think there's much hope of getting prison reform in Russia before there's regime change. But they have been able to do a lot on behalf of individual inmates. Basically, they've set up a sort of clearinghouse for information. They get people to write in or call in about abuses in prisons. And then they mobilize people to pay attention to a particular prison. So start calling, start writing, lawyers to start filing complaints. And they just save people from inhumane conditions or from extreme punishment in these prisons. They also have a very active international life, which includes an appearance on the House of Cards. And I think they've tried to use this well. And one of the things that I've been really impressed with is that they've really tried to always find something that they can talk about locally. So when they went to Australia, they met with local prisoners' rights activists and ask them about what issues they should bring up in their Australian media appearances, and faithfully reproduce that message. They did the same thing when they went to New York, and they asked to be able to visit prisons, which was complicated, but they got a couple of visits in, but they also met with activists, and they bring up issues. I think sometimes it's a little awkward, and in the parallels I sometimes facile, but I think it's a sophisticated and extremely well intentioned effort.
Hi there. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the state of independent journalism in Russia as it is. It seems to slowly be deteriorating.
Oh, this will be a very short answer. There's basically one print magazine left. There's one web-based television channel that used to have satellite and cable outlets and now is pretty much limited to the web. And the fact that it's still functioning is a miracle and a testament to the incredible strength of the people who run it. There are a couple of online publications, but they are increasingly difficult for people to access because the Consumer Authority, which has been given almost unlimited ability to block access to various resources, has blocked access to them, which makes them very difficult to edit in addition to being very difficult to read, right? Because you can't access the back end any easier than the front end. There was a very good and very big online publication called Lenta.ru, which was basically purged last year. So its former editor-in-chief has gone into exile and is running a Russian language publication from Riga in Latvia with a small editorial staff in Riga and a lot of reporters based on the ground in Russia, and it's quite good. But I think that, and it's another heroic effort. It's really sad that that the most important online publication is now has to be run from exile. And of course, the moment will come when the Consumer Authority will block access to it.
Well, I want to thank everybody for coming, and Masha Gessen, Peter Finn, thank you very much.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and 91.7 KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's guest was journalist and activist Masha Gessen, whose new book is The Brothers, The Road to an American Tragedy. She was joined in conversation by Peter Finn, national security editor of The Washington Post. The recording engineers at the JCCSF are Brandon Battaglia, Ben Bernardi, Maya Finley, and Alex Espelay. David Kwan edits and produces the program, and Matt Martin is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Rashanim Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. I'm Barbara Lane. Thanks for listening.